Oh, such a clutch off-season pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Shop Blinds.com right now and get up to 40% off select styles, plus a free professional measure and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Save up to 40% at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
But dude averages 18 yards after catch.
We get it. When you're passionate about something, you go all in. You live entirely in that world. That's exactly how Graybar is about renewable energy projects.
He's all fourth quarter, such a
sleeper. Join our league of clean energy at Graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Do you believe you were wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
Good morning, folks. We hope that everyone had a great weekend. A little chilly this morning, which is it's kind of nice going out, having a jacket on for the first time in a number of months. Been waiting for a little bit of the winter weather. It was kind of nice to have it arrive, finally. Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, will join us in the noon hour. We'll go behind financial headlines and talk about the U.S. Treasury and the breach there. We'll also talk about the crisis in New Orleans, downtown office buildings, dynamic pricing, what does it mean, and other economic issues. Arthur Hardy joins us at 11:30, editor and publisher of the Mardi Gras Guide. There are maybe some potential changes to Mardi Gras, and we'll talk with Arthur about that. The committee on Mardi Gras will be meeting, I think, this afternoon at 1 p.m. and or at 10 a.m. maybe this morning, and we'll visit with Arthur about that. Bernie Pensinot joins us in the 11 o'clock hour, political analyst, and we'll talk about the reelection of Louisiana Representative Mike Johnson as the House Speaker. We'll talk about this notion of bipartisanship, and we'll talk about a number of issues in politics as well as some of the new laws that are coming into effect as of January 1. We have been talking a lot about this past week since the tragic events of the terrorist attack on Bourbon Street, and this thing has taken a number of twists and turns and is getting to be even more complicated in many respects. And I hope that we just don't lose sight of what the end game is going to be here. I had this conversation with a number of folks last week on air, a lot of folks off air as well, as to where does this all end up. There's no doubt that criticism lies in many different places. And I said earlier on, it wasn't about the bollards, it's about the execution. It's interesting where the paths that we're going down. But there are a couple of things that we know for sure, right? Islamic jihadism is alive and well. And as one author put it, you may not be interested in terrorism, but terrorism is interested in you. There was a great piece by Andrew McCarthy where he said the following. Fundamentalist Islam, which is better described as Sharia supremacism, is an authoritative interpretation of Islam. It may not be the authoritative interpretation. Islamic practice and belief is diverse, so the authoritative version really doesn't exist, but it is undoubtedly an authoritative interpretation. So dominant is it in the Muslim Middle East that it is accepted as authoritative even by Muslims who in their private thoughts and lives do not necessarily believe it or practice it. Because it is an Islam supported by more than a millennium of scholarship and championed by some of the world's most influential Muslim nations, such as Qatar and Saudi Arabia, Establishments such as Al-Azhar University in Cairo, organizations such as the Muslim Brotherhood and its global tentacles, and figures such as the late Sheikh Yusuf Qaradawi, as well as Turkey strongman Recep Tayyip Erdogan, a key backer of the Brotherhood, Hamas, and Sunni jihadists, tied to such groups as Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But what most importantly, under this fundamentalist interpretation, it is the duty of Muslims to spread Islam by implementing Sharia, Allah's law and societal framework. This can be done in many ways. One of the ways undeniably endorsed by Scripture is jihad, otherwise known as struggle. In Allah's cause, the spread of Islam, in its classic understanding, jihad is a military struggle. Jihad is considered defensive when Muslims deem themselves under attack, which case all Muslims are obliged to support the jihad. Under attack is in the eye of the beholder. Sharia supremacists perceive Islam to be under attack. For example, if a territory that was once under Muslim rule falls under the control of non-Muslims, or if Muslims form an enclave in the West and a local government interferes with their determination to live under Sharia structures rather than the jurisdiction's laws, or if Muslims are aggressors and the aggrieved people dare to fight back. This is kind of a description of what we are actually dealing with. I said early on, pick a city, pick a state, pick a country, you're going to have any number of potential problems, threats. When we engage in what we do to try and minimize the risk, we're not going to eliminate all risk. That's never going to happen. But what's interesting is that whether or not we actually talk about this enough, whether or not we actually deal with this enough, federal level, state level, local level, or otherwise. And it really doesn't have much to do with what we did or we didn't do on New Year's Day morning. But the evidence is overwhelming as to what's going on. When you look at the list of attacks, New York Times had an interesting article where they outlined a series of attacks and plots either inspired or aided by ISIS over the past 5 years. And they say it's much longer than most people realize. I thought it was worthy of reading this, so we could gain a better understanding and put it in context. A double suicide bombing in the Philippines that killed at least 14 people in 2020. Several attacks in France, including the beheading of a teacher in 2020, the fatal knifing of three people in a church in Nice in 2020, and the killing of a teacher in a small city of Arras in 2023. The killing of four people by a gunman in a bustling Vienna neighborhood in 2020. The fatal stabbing of a British member of parliament in 2021 while he was meeting with constituents inside a church in a seaside town. A suicide bombing at the international airport in Kabul, Afghanistan, that killed 13 U.S. troops and roughly 170 civilians in August of 2021. The stabbing of six people at a supermarket in New Zealand in September 2021. Two attacks in Israel in March 2022 that killed a total of six people. A mass shooting in Oslo, apparently targeting LGBT pride events, that killed two people and wounded 21 in June of 2022. The fatal shooting of two Swedish soccer fans in Brussels in 2023. A bombing in eastern Iran that killed about 100 people attending a ceremony honoring Qasem Soleimani, the deceased Iranian general, just over a year ago. The killer of a worshiper at a Catholic church in Istanbul by two gunmen last January. A mass shooting at a suburban Moscow concert hall that killed 145 people and injured more than 500 last March. The fatal shooting of six people near a Shiite mosque in Oman last summer. A foiled plot to bomb a Taylor Swift concert last summer in Austria that the authorities believe could have killed hundreds. The fatal stabbing of three people at a festival in western Germany in August. Attacks in Afghanistan, Democratic Republic of Congo, Iraq, Niger, Pakistan, and Syria that together have killed hundreds of people. So that is kind of an illustrative list over the last 5 years of incidents that were inspired or aided by ISIS. The evidence is clear that Islamic jihadism is alive and well, and it is a threat to our society and our community that we have to come to grips with. And maybe there needs to be a more concentrated and concerted effort in the development of actionable intelligence so that we are empowered to put in place the measures necessary to protect us each and every day. One has to ask, though, why is terrorism a slippery slope for law enforcement to discuss? There's been this sensitization as it relates to the Muslim community in the manner in which we talk about this, the reluctance for us to talk about the connections between religious beliefs and what is actually happening in this reign of terror across the world. We need to get over that. Facts are facts. We need to talk about what is actually happening out there and the threats that are being made to our way of life. As one author reporter put it, one investigates based on educated suspicion, and you move forward on that premise, collecting the data. But not be shy about calling things out for what they are at the point in time in the investigation. It's going to be interesting to see where we here ultimately end up. What are my concerns? Right now, the best that I can put together, it seems as though we may have four independent investigations that are going on at the local level and state level. AG Liz Morrell says she's going to have an investigation. Councilpersons at large Moreno and Morrell say that they're going to have an investigation. Councilman Oliver Thomas has indicated that he's going to individually conduct an investigation. The city administration is asking possibly someone like former NYPD Chief Bill Bratton to conduct an investigation. One thing that I know for certain, based on my years of experience, that's too many people involved in an investigation. And we will get at cross purposes with one another, and there will be a lot of friction that will be generated as it relates to this. Now, I don't want to be overly critical, but this is something you would expect to see in a banana republic. Someone, somewhere, somehow in this city, hopefully someone apolitical, can stand up and kind of bring people to the table and let's think less emotional and political about this. Let there be no doubt, we have elections in October of this year, and that's very much influencing a lot of what is actually going on here. Let's call it for what it is, and let's step back, look at ourselves in the mirror critically and recognize what path are we going to take? Because you know what we have at risk, folks? That I don't think a lot of people are talking about. And I say this all the time. Let the facts come out first before we start passing judgment, engaging in conjecture, this, that, thinking about what remedial efforts are going to be emotionally. Let's implement things that actually make us safe, not just feel safe. We don't need more soundbite politicians running around all over the place talking about this. Because our reputation as a city, as a city that's built to host, as a city that's about to host the NADA, the Super Bowl, Mardi Gras that we host every year, is at risk. Is at risk of being impaired. And unless we can speak with one voice, there is a benefit to the exercise of an investigation. But we don't need four, five, six independent investigations here. My suspicion at the end of any of these investigations is simply going to be this. We know what security measures we have a desire to implement. It's not rocket science, right? it's fairly easy to recognize what needs to be done. What's not easy is to execute. And what we're not talking about is the execution of whatever plan that may be out there. We already know what there's been several reports done about what we need to do once we decided that the French Quarter was a place worthy of heightened security. What I don't hear anybody saying is who's responsible when, why, and how in the execution of whatever that plan may be. So, for example, we are replacing security measures that are less effective than the ones that exist today that we're removing. Who made that decision? That's what I would like to know. And why was that decision made? And what is going to be the risk tolerance that we accept as a city? And who makes that decision? And are they folks that are actually communicating with one another about that happenstance? That is of much more value, in my view, than a lot of what we're talking about. Because you can have the best plan in the world, but if you're not and you don't have the players that can effectively and efficiently implement anything that is brought to the forefront, that's provided as a remedial measure, it's not worth the paper it's written on. What is the governance structure? We have individuals that have a lot of titles throughout city government, throughout state government, throughout the federal government. How do we go about compelling communication and acting on that intelligence? And who ultimately makes these decisions? At some point in time, there were bollards that were implemented, executed on, that provided a certain level of security, otherwise stopping power of a certain size vehicle at a certain speed, and now the new ones provide less than. Why would we do that? Who thought that was a good idea? Did it go through a value engineering process where maybe the dollars or the money wasn't available? Who decides when we're actually going to utilize all of these security measures? Is there a review process as it relates to the nature of the event that's going on at that particular time where someone can be held accountable for making the decisions, no, we will not put bollards in place. No, we will not put this security measure in place. Or yes, we will. Who is that person? Where is that person? After all this period of time, 6 days later, no one knows that. It's not been reported on. And therein lies the problem. Not what needs to be put into place, but who is responsible for making these decisions and picking and choosing what events do we actually deploy, what level of security measures that we have available to us. Who's bringing the facts about the assets that we have that we can deploy to minimize risk, and how do we go about doing it? On what date, what time, when do they come down? Is it a daily occurrence? Whatever it may be. Who are those people? I don't know about you, but I have not heard a single thing about any of that. The additional problem that we have is that we really need to come together. We are asking the federal government to go to a level one for the Super Bowl as well as Mardi Gras. Super Bowl obviously has received that designation over and over and over again. Mardi Gras, no. I could make a strong argument on behalf of Mardi Gras. I think most everybody could. But who's actually in control of that? Who's going to present the information and everything else? Or are we just expecting the federal government to make an emotional decision at this point in time, one that we're ultimately going to have to defend over and over and over again? And who's collectively bringing all of this together, the data and otherwise, to make the case so that we don't have to go through this exercise over and over and over again? Does anybody know the answer to that question? Have we spent a lot of time talking about that at all? These are the things and the considerations that go into the execution side of all of this, and we're not talking about it. We're reacting emotionally with, we need more, this security measure, that security, we need this, we need that, we need an expert to come in and tell us. We know what has to be done. If we have the appropriate people in the positions that should be addressing this, we know exactly what has to be done. What we obviously don't know is how to go about doing it, maintaining it, making sure that the care and custody of these measures are met each and every day, and that they are, in fact, operational 24/7, 365. And until we reach this point, we will tend to look a little bit like a banana republic. We'll be right back. We'd love to hear from you. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line.
You might think financial crime is all about money, but sometimes it ends in murder. I'm Nicole Lappin, host of Money Crimes, a Crime House original podcast. Each episode features a thrilling story about the dark side of finance and how to protect yourself from it. Follow and listen to Money Crimes, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Crime House Studios, available on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This time of year, a good hoodie is absolutely essential. But these days, it's tough to find one that will last through the season. That's why the American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime, so you can count on it to bring you comfort and warmth year after year. Slate Magazine called it the greatest hoodie ever made, and from cotton to zipper, it's made right here in the USA. It's crafted with timeless style, heavyweight fleece, a double-lined hood, and reinforced elbow patches, which means this hoodie can withstand any outing or adventure. It'll be your new favorite hoodie, and you can depend on it for years to come. Plus, buying from American Giant means supporting local communities of farmers, manufacturers, and more. This season, snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip, and save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code CLASSIC24 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com. Code CLASSIC24.
And stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We'll go to the talk lines here in just a second. One of the council members for the city of New Orleans sent me a release that they made this morning, January 6, 2025, that they would be supportive of the Louisiana Attorney General Liz Murrell's announcement that her office would be conducting an investigation into the Bourbon Street terror attack, and that they have been in communication and they will be a supportive partner throughout this process. That's a direct quote from Council President Helena Moreno. So maybe things are moving in the right direction here, hopefully so that we all get on the same page. Let's go to Jeannie on line one. Jeannie, what say you?
Hey, the first thing that happened on the first press conference on Wednesday morning, Kentrell and Kirkpatrick and the FBI special agent all studiously avoided saying that they had killed this guy, that they had his name, or that he wasn't any of the information that would have been useful, particularly whether he was dead or among us, and still able to do anything to hurt those of us who are out in the city. Why did they do that? That fits right in with what you're saying about how they're avoiding talking about the people who are doing this, the perpetrators. The man's name was clearly available in his wallet with his driver's license. And now the fact is that it would have led people to some possible decisions about who is religion or his ancestry were, but they told us that by 11 o'clock, so it really wasn't going to stay a secret. Why did they not tell us? But I was especially disturbed that they didn't tell us that he was dead, because I was worried he was out there. And I'm like, I'm an Algerine. Who needs to know that there's somebody just across the river who could be coming over to bother me?
Yeah, I'm not going to engage in conjecture as to why they did what, when, why, and how. I can just tell you my personal experience in dealing with investigations, and when you release certain pieces of information to the public, all has to do with trying to validate some of the preliminary information that you have before you actually release it. And I believe that that's a good practice. I think you try to put out as much information as you possibly can at the very beginning that you're relatively sure about, that you have a certain amount of been able to validate some of that information, and you put it out. Otherwise, in many cases, it's sometimes better to wait a little while. And there, as you
but
know,
we did
there
know
was
he
this,
was dead.
Yeah, well, that is something that was, evident and obviously was going to get out because of the number of people on the crime scene, right? And I know that was hitting the social networks long before it was ever released by any of the officials. So I can't disagree with you there because, I saw it out in social media before it was ever released.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that one thing could have been handled better just from the point of view of those of us
who are out there
watching television, because that's where we get our world.
There's going to be a lot of things like that, right? And I would just ask that folks be not too judgmental. You have this type of attack that thankfully hadn't happened here that often. The reason I read this list was to give everybody a snapshot of what actually has been going on around the world, that we shouldn't be surprised about an event like this because it's been repeating itself out there for a number of years. And then the cooperation that needs to happen, and more importantly, the coordination between federal, state, and locals as to who's going to take the lead in the investigation, who's going to do this, who's going to be responsible for that. It's a little sloppy at first, and you try and get it cleaned up as much as possible in the hours following the event. A lot of times some are very successful in doing so before they ever talk to the public for the first time. I don't want to be overly critical of that process. One of the reasons I mentioned this thing about terrorism and about Islamic jihadists is that we have this friction that's out there relative to the sensitivity to the Muslim community. And, they feel like a lot of times they are mischaracterized as the way that we deal with some of this information. But we shouldn't be shy to talk about it if we have, facts available to us at that point in time. And everybody has to have gain a better understanding of what this is about. And these religious ideologies are driving a lot of what's going on, and we can't be shy about talking about that. Well, Jeannie, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Tommy. Tommy, you're up.
Thanks for taking my call. I haven't been listening, so I don't know if my comment's going to be relative or not. But reference to the barricades that are installed, typically say on St. Peter Street, if a perpetrator wanted to risk going against traffic, he could just go up Rampart to St. Peter, turn right, and there are no barricades. What I'm saying is against traffic flow.
Right. Well, there are places for bollards at every corner on both sides. The question is, who makes the decision to deploy them? And on this particular night, they were not deployed, many of which were being repaired or replaced at that point in time in advance of the Super Bowl. It goes to the point that I was making about who makes that decision, when, why, and how, and based on what information, We haven't heard a lot of discussion about that. And as I said before, we have a lot of people with a lot of titles that it would seem that these types of decisions would fall under their purview and authority. Hadn't really heard from any of those folks. And we hadn't really had a discussion and no information offered up by the mayor as to who actually makes these decisions. And I'm not necessarily sure that these decisions fall within the purview of the NOPD. I've been told otherwise, which is kind of interesting as well. Thank you for the call, Tommy. Let's go to Anthony. Anthony, you're up.
Hey, how you doing, Lou? Good morning.
Good. Good morning.
Look, this is my problem I have with it. You know, everybody hates to see senseless people's lives being wasted like this here, right? Mm-hmm. And my heart go out to them people. But my point is, you lose 400 and something people a year in the city, right? And I don't see all this protection or nobody talk about or bring out the government, bring out the military, bring out all these forces that they done brought out for this occasion. All these forces that they done brought out for this occasion. I don't see them bring no forces out. They give you excuses about they running short on police officers. They running short on this. They don't have this and that and the other. When you lose 400 and something people every year to senseless violence in the city, and in this instance, you got the Gail Bethum coming out. You got what Gail Bethum when it's time to talk about the 400 and something people that lose their life senseless in the city. Why they don't talk then, but they talking now?
Well, it's hard to disagree with you, Anthony. I mean, I say this all the time. Where are all the folks every day with the conflict that we have, not only in this city, but in other cities across the country, where we're losing to murder, whether it be domestic murders or otherwise, the victim and the perpetrator murders, that they know one another, you know, and the violence in the streets? Where's the hue and cry of the community? Where's the hue and cry from any number of governmental agencies or otherwise? It's simply just not there, right? This is a little bit of a different issue as it relates to an act of terrorism, where you have a lot of completely and totally innocent people that are being killed. They just happen to be walking down the sidewalk or in a pedestrian mall area. But it brings up a good point as it relates to our tolerance level that we have for a lot of different things. And the community response, quite frankly, for years in the city, has been lacking. And we make decisions and we elect people that have exhibited a tolerance for violence in this city. They don't really get very proactive on that issue, and we keep electing people over and over and over again that don't actually bring to bear the conversations, the communication necessary in order to try and solve some of these issues, and are less than honest about talking about some of these issues as well. Not all, thankfully. Otherwise, I think the situation could be much worse. And that's not unique to just the city of New Orleans. And that's not necessarily a criticism of the city of New Orleans. That's a mindset of communities across this country that we just seem to be willing to accept certain levels of violence in our community. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Give us a shout. This is Newell on WWL. Welcome back, folks. We were talking about some observations that I made relative to this terrorist attack on Bourbon Street. Islamic jihadists is alive and well. Also said that you may not be interested in terrorism, but terrorism is interested in you, and that we investigate this based on educated suspicion. And a lot of times we deliver information to the public at certain times that makes sense relative to the investigation and not always about the public's ability or right to know. And we've had some callers that have been a little frustrated with that as well. Let's go to Ken. Ken, you're up. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, sir. I agree with everything you said in your opening statements. My my question, I'm wondering, as far as the Attorney General conducting an investigation, I don't see where the fact that the security measures in place in the city of New Orleans were not executed upon come under the purview of the Attorney General. I personally feel she's just trying to gain political capital by her and a lot of others saying, oh, I'm going to start an investigation.
Well, she is. She's in a position where I think it is pertinent. But I agree with your point. The internal deliberations of city government and governance over this issue. We have a director of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness. We hadn't heard from that individual, but we hadn't heard from the city at all as to how these decisions are made, who makes them. Is there a meeting? Is there a committee that comes together? Who decides what security preventative measures are going to be put in place or otherwise? And was there even a meeting about New Year's Eve? I mean, that would be a place to start. I mean, I don't know about you, but my inquiring mind would like to know who actually met, who actually discussed what was going to happen. I'm confident that members of the NOPD met amongst one another, and as it relates to their staffing, capital placement, where they're going to be distributed around the French Quarter and the like. But these overall decisions about these security measures that are in place, who's responsible for it? We haven't heard anybody talking about that at all. And I, like you, am kind of curious as who's that decision maker. I suspect it's not the mayor, or it shouldn't be the mayor for certain. She's not a subject matter expert in that regard, and I'm sure she defers to someone. She hasn't said. I mean, I'd be curious to know, but it's going to be interesting to see where this all ends up. I'm not so sure that that's what the AG is going to be looking at, but I might be wrong. Thank you, Ken, for the call. Let's go to Hank. Hank, you're up. What say you?
Well, you just covered what I wanted to talk. Who's in charge of the what if? At work, there's always a what if. What if this happens? What if that happens? Who's in charge of that?
Don't know.
There's got to be somebody. Somebody's in charge of that what if. I mean, on the football team, we got a what if walkthrough. At work, you got a what if walkthrough. You were a sheriff. Did you have any what if walkthroughs?
Well, we did. We had preparation meetings every year. As redundant as Mardi Gras is, you know, with the same route, the same crews for the most part, you know, it's easy to fall into this level of complacency. But my predecessor, Harry Lee, approached it this way, and I did as well. We always had a meeting. We always, gained an understanding of what assets we had available, what assets were down, what was available to us, how were they going to be deployed, so forth and so on, even to the point of the location of our command post. Where was it going to be? If there was construction on Causeway, for example, what would be the best location for us to move it to, depending on a circumstance that changed from the previous year? And we had these meetings every year with every event that we ever participated in, that we had a lot of folks, that would be in one place or the other. Same thing with the Irish parade, the Irish-Italian parade. All of these things were discussed as to the equipment that we had, whether or not, even to the point of the preventive maintenance programs that we had for these pieces of equipment. So for example, we have these international trucks that we purchased in the aftermath of Katrina. We discussed the preventive maintenance program on those trucks all the time, every year, to make sure that we're starting those trucks on a weekly basis and driving those trucks on, every so often. So that we maintain the integrity of the tires and the this and the that. To make sure that all of these assets, because when we needed them, We can't have them broken down and trying to piece them in together in order to respond to something. You never know. I mean, we deployed, I think those trucks were on loan to New Orleans in the aftermath of this event. I mean, these trucks have been around since 2006, if my memory serves me correct. Here we are in 2024, and we're still using them. Why? Because we maintain them. You know, we treat them as a critical asset, provide the preventive maintenance, make sure they're operational all the time. But that's a mindset that you have to have about all of your equipment. That all goes into what I talk about with execution, you know, and without being able to execute, without having those critical assets necessary that you need operational and functioning, I don't care how good your security plan is, you're not going to be able to execute on it. There are a lot of other touchstones that you have to touch, that you have to be mindful of, that you need to talk about on a monthly or biannual basis, whatever you feel is necessary, but it needs to be discussed. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. Let's go to Frank. You're up. Frank, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm going to be very quick on this and listen to your answer. First of all, we have a head of Homeland Security. Like you said, I haven't heard from him. So maybe he should be the one to tell us we had the equipment to put out there but didn't. And I thought the news conference that I watched on that Wednesday was a banana republic. It was all of them on the run up there and get their faces on TV so everybody can see what they're doing. I don't need that. And I'm a combat Vietnam veteran. And I'm going to tell you this. I've been saying for years to my family and close friends that this was eventually going to happen and that Mardi Gras is a very soft target.
I would agree with you, Frank. It's not a question. It's a question of if, not when. I'm sorry. It's not a question of if. It's a question of when. Said it backwards. I couldn't agree with you more. And I'd like to know, you know, who's in charge of making these decisions. Maybe we'll find out. Maybe not.